Talking landscape photography with Kristen Fletcher and Carwin.
We are joined by a very special guest today. Her name is Jackie Rankin. She's based in New Zealand, and she's going to talk to us a little bit about the Mono Awards later too, which is I think that the judging for that is June 13. Is that right, Jackie?
Well,
June 14.
It's not far away. That's right.
June 14.
June 13, 14. Yeah.
The judges generally know less than the participants in these things. It's like, oh, what? I've got to judge it now. Oh, hang on. What do you mean I've only got 2 days to do it? Oh. that's usually my reaction when these things happen. You've been doing a lot of judging, haven't you, Jackie? You've judged all over the place for how many years now? Since 2000 or something?
2002 was when I began judging the Australian Photographic Awards.
Yeah.
At APA. Yeah. Yep. And I've been judging every year since then. And then now in New Zealand since 2004. Oh, yeah, 2004.
Mm. Yeah.
So it wasn't soon after that.
And what was the most amount of entries you've ever had to judge in one sitting? Because I've got a bit of a story about, and I reckon I can just about beat everyone. But what do you reckon? What was the most amount of entries in any sort of competition that you've ever had to judge?
Well, I wouldn't know. Maybe it was 1,300, 1,600, you know, something like that.
Yeah, that's quite a lot. That's a few. Yeah.
Carwin. What about you? Come on.
I judged a competition, a Jetstar photographic competition, and who was I with? Bill. Anyway, Bill.
That's not the guy, Bill.
Anyway, we had my share. There was 30,000 entrants, and I had 11,600 and something or other photos that I had to judge. Mm. It went on and on, and the payment was $1,100 worth of free flights on Jetstar.
So lucky. Okay,
Jackie. When you're judging these sort of comps, and particularly, you know, bearing in mind that the whole of New Zealand and pretty much the whole of Australia has been in lockdown, do you have any idea what you're going to be looking for this year? Like, for instance, are you going to make concessions for people like myself that have probably just taken photos of their car keys this year? Or
well, if I see some images that seem to represent some sort of sense of isolation, you know, I might respond to that because it's, you know, something that's I've experienced in the last couple of weeks. Mm. Well, isolation, Queenstown was not so isolated, but Twizel, where we're living now, is much more. Mm. Oh, look, what am I after? I think an image that's got emotion, number one, you know, emotion that tells me a bit of a story, that kind of a narrative, you know, people, we talk about narratives, the story, because how do you say a story with a photograph? Well, it's about what's in the photograph and what's not in the photograph. So what it alludes to, it's what's outside the frame. So there's a bigger story happening in there somewhere, but it's not as evident straight away. Mm. So they're not easy images to make, really. But you stick with it for a while. You don't pass it by. I can imagine, Christian, when you're judging all those photographs, it would have been, yeah, no. Oh, maybe this one, and then I have to actually look at this one a bit longer to work it out. Mm. Those kind of things.
Let's go back to the start, Jackie. You know, I think you're one of the most creative photographers that I've been around and seen. You know, 35 years of experience in visual arts. So, how did photography become so important to you? How did it all come about?
Look, it was just living my life, because it started so early on when I was 15, photographing greyhounds on a racetrack. That was my weekend job, you know. And the creative arts was also outside of that. You know, I studied painting and ceramics, and I loved the idea of making. And, you know, I really liked the idea of making pots and things, but I couldn't sell a lot of pots to make a living. Mm. But I was already a photographer, and so that's always kept going. But I've always had that inkling just to go and make things. And, you know, even now in this sense of lockdown, you know, I've been getting out my power tools and making things, cutting things down, and really in just enjoying that. So it's not only about photography; it's about that kind of balance. But photography did become a business, so you have to spend time with it, and that means marketing and emails and newsletters and lots of things like that. Keeping connected, you just can't disappear. I'd sort of kind of like to disappear sometimes.
So yeah. Jackie, you were 15 when you first picked up the camera.
Yes. Before that. That 15 when I first started to get my first job photographing greyhounds. Yeah. 16. So my dad gave me a camera, I suppose, when I was about 12, taking little snaps of the family holidays and things like that.
What was your first camera? Remember?
My first... I remember a couple. There was these little tiny ones that took 110 film, and they used to chuck them... them backwards, in and out thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
I remember those. And ones with a little camera, and a little, you could get the little flashes on top that you'd flick around, and then you have to, they'd have four little flashes and you'd toss them away. Yeah. Those kind of things, Real camera, though, was a Yashica TL. That was a Christmas present. And then it wasn't long after that that I saw a job advertised for a photographer, and I went, I'll give that a go, and managed to snavel that, and kept that job going for many, many years.
And that was photographing the greyhounds, was it?
Yeah, but the greyhounds turned into photographing the horses as well, and trotting, and then all the presentations, and all the skills that you build up over the years while you're still doing other things. Yeah.
So do you have a gambling habit now after all those years of...
No.
Okay.
No. No, right. I did put some bets on.
Yeah, oh, really?
You get to know a couple of jockeys, and they go, maybe give it a go. Oh, they were just country meetings. They were New South Wales, from Wagga to Albury to Goulburn, kind of thing.
What sort of photography was it?
That was photographing the horses going past the post.
Ah.
So they were the winning photographs for the owners of the horse, and they... That included that moment of going past the post where you needed to allow the subject to lead through the frame, not be in the middle of the frame, otherwise you end up with half an empty frame. Mm. So it was about letting the horse lead through the frame, have something on the finish line, and also some other horses or other dogs or something else going on.
Did you ever stuff it up? Like just get an empty frame? Or?
No,
I would.
I do remember once. Oh no, I do remember cutting off the nose of a dog, but that was early on, and it was painted back in because it was all in film back in those days.
Oh yeah, all right.
And it was my boss painted it in and added a bit on the edge just through colour, and he was pretty amazing. Yeah.
Oh wow! So obviously, growing up in rural New South Wales, I believe your dad was a pilot back in those days, and had his own tiger moth. And I remember in 2002, I was sitting at home, and my wife said, "Hey, Christian, come here, have a look at this. Look at what's on TV." And it was this person, this Jackie Rankin lady, who just won the Australian Professional Photographer of the Year. And I think was it Steve Lehman back then interviewing you? Would it have been?
No, Tracy.
Tracy Grimshaw?
Yes. Tracy.
And
it was very funny.
That was the Today Show, wasn't it?
It was the Good Morning Today Show. Yeah, one of those.
Today shows. Something like that. I was watching this, and then they were probably some of the first aerial photographs I'd seen. Not seen, but you were doing aerials way back then. And were you won the obviously the Australian Professional Photographer of the Year. Was it all from based on those aerial photos, or was it other photos in there as well?
No, it was only Australia's ever only been four images, and they pretty well needed to be in just one category, so they were in the landscape category.
Yep.
This was at 1999, I started photographing upside down in my dad's biplane. Mm. All the photographs were made while performing a loop because in a biplane, the front wing would get in the way, and looking straight down is a problem, as you know.
Yeah.
But doing a loop meant that I could see something on the ground, I would say to Dad, and we'd point to it, and through the microphone, that's, you know, amazing. And an old biplane, you don't have much area, you don't have this kind of communication. Yeah. So pointing and things did it. We'd start to dive down, and if you dive down and then pull over the top, you start pulling back on the loop. When you're over your subject, you'll end up at the top of the loop over the top, and that's the time to take the photograph. So it was just one exposure per loop, and then I'd wind on my 120 medium format. What was it? Mamiya 7 camera back then.
That is amazing. We had an aerial special at the start of this year, Jackie, and we spoke to a number of aerial specialists, and you know, we were talking about, you know, what the most comfortable plane is, and the best helicopter, the most stable for taking aerial shots. Yeah. And you hear stories like yours, you know, doing it upside down in one shot. Did you get many good shots, or was it just hit and miss?
No, it wasn't hit and miss. You know when you got a shot, it gets you in the stomach. No, not just the loop either. Mm. But you can feel the shapes coming together, and there are moments, you know, the hard part was I'd get excited and I'd go, oh, that was great, maybe I did miss it a bit, do it again, Dad, and you do another second loop, but the G-force would be stronger. But then it was lost, but I really, that's what excites me about those kind of photographs, and even photographs from a moving car now and things like that, is that there's that fleeting moment where you're also using a bit of instinct. Mm. You know, that, yeah, it's there, but you still have to have your shutter speed right and your focusing right, and you have to have an idea, and you need a subject. It's not just random.
So when you're in that situation, when you're upside down in an aeroplane about to take a shot, is there, you know, does time slow down? Do you sort of go, okay, I've got 2 or 3 seconds here to compose? Like, what actually goes through your head in, you know, when you're upside down at 3,000 feet taking an aerial shot?
Don't drop the camera.
Well, when my idea was to look straight down, so I didn't have to consider the horizon. If I'm doing any other aerial photography and it includes, then it's not looking straight down, I'm always trying to be aware of where the horizon is and come down from that. That just sort of feels right. Mm. So as far as that 1 or 2 seconds, that's when thinking can get in the way, because you're really trying to respond to just shape and form and the mark making on the ground, whatever was attracting me at that moment would actually be upside down and back to front. So I've forgotten about that, what I was thinking I was seeing. It was just looked interesting, and then when it looks upside down and back to front, because you're actually doing a loop, remember. So it's a little bit like you know, I suppose a photograph that you might be working on, and if you turn it upside down and back to front on your computer, you're seeing it in a new way, and you can see whether there's some imbalances there too. So it helps you to weed out the good subjects, I guess.
Yeah, and are you still doing aerials, Jackie? Or because I'm not sure if I've seen many in your portfolio of late. Have you given up the aerials? Or
well, my flying tripod, which was my father, he's not in New Zealand, and he actually passed away about 5 years ago. Yeah, so that was part of that that energy too, was that relationship I had with my dad. So when I moved to New Zealand, really back in 2002, I stopped making that considered series of aerials. I still will photograph from the Boeing going from Queenstown to Christchurch. You know, I've had a few good shots out the window.
Yeah, private jet. We all wish we could have one of those.
Yeah, and we've had some quite a few helicopter flights that we do on our workshops, and you know, I'm always looking, but it's different now.
Why New Zealand? Why the change?
So I came to New Zealand with Mike Langford, who's now my husband, and we got married, you know, about 10 years ago. Mm. But and New Zealand, it was that time of change, 2002-03. Digital had come in. You know, Mike was a commercial shooter in Sydney. We'd got together around that time. We'd been together maybe 12 or 14 months or something, and then Mike's sort of his commercial work changed, and it was a time of change for the TAFE system. I was teaching at TAFE, and there was a lot more paperwork involved and less hands-on, and all the black and white dark rooms were closing down. It was all becoming digital, and it was like, you know, time of change and time to move. So So we moved to New Zealand because we began a school of photography in Queenstown. You know, that's inspired by people like Richard White, a good friend who unfortunately passed away a little while ago. And you know, workshops were part of the future because digital was offering so much more. It wasn't about film. You know, you were able to give immediate feedback and help people through that process. And Canon was great. They came on board and gave us a whole bunch of cameras so people could actually learn how to use a real camera, you know, not just a point-and-shoot sort of clicky film camera as they were. So that was, that's why New Zealand. It's a great destination. Mike was familiar. Mike actually grew up in New Zealand, and it's only, you know, a couple of hours, 3 hours across the ditch from Sydney.
Yeah. I mean, some people would say that you guys have got, you know, you've got it made. You're working and photographing in one of the most beautiful places on earth, and everyone goes, oh, when the shit goes down, I'm going to New Zealand. And we all want to go there. You know, we all like the politics over there. It all seems very good from over here. It seems good. And, of course, the landscapes. As a landscape shooter, I mean, you can't get much better than New Zealand. Do you get out shooting very often, or how often do you make images?
Well, we try and make images every week, you know. Even this morning we woke up and it was a bit of a frost around and the fog.
He
said, let's get out. And I said, oh, no, I've got to do some things on the computer. got to answer some emails. I've got some books out. I've got a newsletter to do.
Bloody podcast.
Bloody podcast coming up. You know, that's my key. That's my key thing. Not bad, bro. We get out a lot. Look, in the lockdown, I didn't have to go far. I had a lot of inspiration from around home, and that included my wood pile and all of the things I've collected along the way, because I love finding things and starting to use those things in my photographs. And when I find them, they become my friend, and I bring them back, and I've got little bits of stick and nests and all sorts of interesting things that I've always wanted to photograph. So I was starting to create little narratives of my lockdown by putting those together in multiple exposures, which is obviously another one of my loves, trying to do in-camera multiple exposures now.
That kind of leads into my next question. I mean, you know, in your career, you've always been so creative and so original with your work. Now, you've had you've got your Rankin hand and the Rankin Cloud, you've been Rankin Cloud, and you've been known to throw stuff up in the air. Toasters and whatever
kitchen.
Else.
Kitchen stories.
Where do these ideas come from? How do these things come up in your imagination?
They often just come up from doing, and then noticing. It's not so much about inspiration from others, but I'm sure that all impacts in the back of your brain. And the more you see, the more visually narrative, the more. So, I guess it allows for those things to come along. But kitchen stories, I can say something about that. It started on a workshop when I gave everybody a challenge to photograph 10 or 15 photographs in a small space. But I knew this challenge was coming up, and we were at a small hotel off in Kinloch, up at the top of the lake beyond Queenstown, and I found a really interesting spatula in the kitchen. So I threw that into my camera bag because, you know, I like finding things. And then I thought, I'll just borrow this. And then I started using this spatula, and I took all sorts of different photographs. I went, I like that. There's something here for me, and I haven't seen it before. And so then I took that spatula, no, my another spatula. I left that one there. On a big trip.
We'll be checking.
Queenstown to Christchurch. And there was still something going on. I just don't like letting things go, so I just kept finding then interesting kitchen utensils, and we'd go through towns and I'd go to the old junk shop and find something from that area and just be brave enough to throw things in the air because I like that, you know, that separation that you can get and the in-camera capture. So it was all about throwing things in the air, being able to capture it before it hit the horizon, finding separation and something sort of incongruous about it. And there's also a sense of freedom. And I think freedom is one of the things my a little call card of mine. I'd like to be free to do whatever I like, and free from, I guess, worrying about what other people think about my photographs, because yeah. So it can be pretty strange. The old rank and hand happened because I was making a photograph originally of a low of a tree, and it was backlit and the sun was just hitting the lens, and so I put my hand up to stop the light from hitting the lens. That was in a proper proper camera, and I had my hand in there, and then when I got back to the studio, I thought, oh, I kind of like my hand in there.
Yeah.
It was big, really deep depth of field, and it was sharp, and so, you know, it was another one of those shots I put into the awards, and it was different, and then I started putting my hand in all in my iPhone shots, because that was the start of Instagram and hashtag, so there's this sort of a hashtag of hashtag Rankinhand sort of started, and that's why I kept doing those. But they were mostly, all the others from then were really iPhone shots.
Yeah.
So, Jackie, do you feel now as though you have freedom to express yourself in photography the way you want to?
Yes. I try and do that. I don't have total economic freedom. Mm. You know, I'd have to win a big lottery, I think, to have that. Yeah. It's as much as I put on myself. I know I had quite a bit of freedom the last seven weeks, but I haven't made a lot of prints and put them onto boards yet, because I'm going through a process of making encaustic prints, encaustic photographs, which is a little bit more expensive because the wax is quite expensive. So I'm trying to make sure the prints are winners, and I'm building up a series before I put them onto all these boards, and all the boards need to be painted and made nice, and so there's a bit of making in the back of that. So that's that bit of craft that's a mixture of me giving me that freedom, but you know, and I guess almost choosing not to enter the awards this year, or because, you know, it's not a print awards, and I really love, you know, making the prints. That gives you a bit more freedom too, to be able to go anywhere in your library and make go back into photographs from 10 years ago and bring them up and give them a new lease of life and enjoy yourself, really.
Now, you said before you like sort of getting out there with your power tools. Is, you know, making stuff a big part of your life? Can you talk us through that? Like, what do you like to make?
Well, in this case, the making part is recycling some of the floorboards that came from our house when we did a renovate when we came here. I don't like throwing things away.
Would they be cowrie? Is that right? Cowrie?
No, these boards were just, they were only, you know, 12 centimetres wide. They were not nice cowrie boards. Mm. No, they were just sort of rubbish stuff you'd normally throw away. Probably with that plastic veneer underneath. Yep. Yeah, they pretend wood. Oh, but it's actually really good substrate for painting on. It's a good substrate. Solid, and it's not going to swell. I can paint it and prepare it to put on a piece of artwork and make something that was going to be thrown into the tip into a piece of art, you know. I like that kind of thing too.
Yeah, this is your creativity that really struck me, because we've done a few workshops together, and I remember one in particular. We were out in the Nevis Valley. Is that what they had? The way you say it? Yep. Nevis. Yeah. And we were all standing there, and there's some tussock grass there, and you know, we're all just doing the just typical me. I'm just doing what I always do. There's the landscape. Put the camera down, the tripod, take a photo, great. And then you count out, and you're standing next to me, and all of a sudden out comes this bloody, this twine that you had, just some string at some like a
That I found just down the road.
Oh, did you find it? Yeah.
I threw it in my camera bag.
Yeah. So anyway, we're standing there, Carmen, and Jackie just starts getting this string and wrapping it around these tussocks and tying it together and just changing it and making all of a sudden it, she made this subject in this foreground that, and I'm just sitting there going, "Friggin' hell! How do people?" And there was another time. It might have been the same trip, but we went out to Walter Peak. I think. That was a really lousy afternoon. It was kind of grey and low cloud, not much happening. I think it might have actually rained really heavily.
Rained.
Yeah. Mm. And you took a photograph of the umbrellas out there on the thing. And, you know, I got there and I was going, there's nothing here. And I was just going through the motions. I get the camera out, point it in a direction and push the button. And then I saw that photo that you took. I think you might have showed me in the back of your camera. And I just went, oh, F word.
Far out.
I see that.
Far out.
Damn it.
Look, yeah. And look, I was so, that's all just about really always being on the edge of waiting for that shot, because you know they don't always come along. And that shot of, you know, that it doesn't exist anymore out there at Walter Peak. It's all changed. And it was the light that day. There was some special something going on with the light. And when you feel that, and you just got to go looking. And when some things you can't see with your eyes, because that's a black and white shot, and it worked in black and white. But you can see it if you change your picture style in the camera to black and white, particularly if you've got a mirrorless camera these days. You know, it's a good way to see in black and white. There's a tip. But I could see it on the viewfinder with live view in black and white, and it really, yeah, I just knew there was something going on there. So,
Jackie, what's what's the closest you've got to, you know, the perfect shot?
Oh, I don't know. I'm still looking for that, aren't we?
You haven't had us in the landscapes yet, Carmen.
Actually,
starts tucking up in the air.
I'm not sure that the perfect shot is the right thing. You know, perfect is you got to have something a little bit wrong, and in fact, it's when there's something not quite right about a picture, and then you're trying to fix it in Photoshop, that, you know, that's when you find something new as well. But yeah, things don't always have to be perfect unless you're putting it into a photographic award and there'll be a judge looking for perfection. You know, so I think I'm still looking for that. I'm still looking, and I guess I'll always look for it, the next best shot.
Do you work mostly in black and white? Because, I mean, a lot of your images are black and white, but you obviously do colour as well. But do you find black and white works better with your creativity or your style?
Since I moved to Twizel, I've been shooting a lot more colour. Freely went, I can shoot colour if I like, you know, I can do this. Just acknowledging that there were some colours there that are coming through. But for many years I was just black and white, and I doggedly, in some ways, doggedly sort of stuck in there, because there is that's a good way to learn your craft as well, is by sticking with one genre for a while and really getting to know it before you sort of go into other things. But I learned how to shoot black and white early on. I processed my first roll of film was black and white in a dark room with my dad again in Goulburn. He had his own dark room, and there's something lovely about that, is that, you know, I have more compassion or more loving the shadows and the details in the shadows, and allowing the lights to blow out. And that giving that gives you some space in a photograph. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm not a real HDR photographer. I tend to like areas of black and, you know, areas of white, and letting those have their own voice, and then the tones and textures in between, that all brings it all together, I guess.
And you've also been doing a lot of multiple exposures, double exposures. Are you doing that in camera, or was that in post in Photoshop?
No, I like to do things in camera as much as I can.
So
with the Canon, it's got an option that it'll take a raw, raw and JPEG of a multiple exposure. Raw, when it is multiple exposure, is more like a JPEG. It doesn't have the dynamic range of a RAW file. But it also saves my separate files as separate files, so I get the multiple exposures and the separate files. Something's not quite right, and I want to have a little bit more detail in an area, I can overlay that original JPEG or RAW file and just to bring a bit of information back.
That's cool.
But I like that the limitations again of trying to get it in camera, because you can do so much in the computer that unless you put your own rules down about what you can and can't do, you can try and do too much or try and make that perfect shot. But when it's in the camera, mistakes happen, and from those mistakes, you know, that's where those new ideas sometimes begin.
Yeah,
you wouldn't have ever thought of.
Yeah, so well, we might try that tomorrow, Cohen, because Cohen and I are currently just mucking around with a Panasonic S1R, Lumix S1R, and that's got a multiple exposure function, and I think you can take up to 4 shots. But what it does, for what I believe, it doesn't it'll take your whites to a certain point, but it won't keep adding to the whites. If you take another shot that's got a lot of white in it, it won't keep adding to that, so you get things blowing out. So I'm not sure how that all would.
Well, that would work pretty much with any multiple exposure. It worked with film that way. If you expose the film to light, you know, there's no way you can pull it back. So it's not a camera. It's not a computer that, you know, in that sense, you can't change those blending modes altogether. So you do have to be very careful about the whites, because they will stay white. Unless there's a couple of modes that you can use. One's like an average mode. And the average, if you have a black and a white and they do overlay, you can get a bit more of a grey. And then you've got additive, which means that you really should underexpose both images so that to bring up a normal exposure.
Cohen and I must have been using the average mode a lot, because our photos have been really average lately.
That's my default average mode. Jackie, look, you're in a beautiful part of New Zealand. You're near like Tekapo, I believe, and what is it, Ruatanifa? Is that another lake as well?
Ruatanifa.
Now,
look, yes, just.
How far away is that from you? Like,
I could ride my push bike to Lake Ruatanifa in about 5 minutes.
Wow.
So just down the road, okay?
Yeah, fast
and
rider.
It's not far. Yeah, I'm really fit now. You know, every day afternoon at about 4 o'clock, go for a bike ride. So it's not that far away. But probably the most attractive lake is just down the road, Pukaki, which is that's the lake that comes off Mount Cook.
Yeah.
Lake Pukaki. And it's pretty marvelous, and all the little ponds, little ponds around the place. And Twizel was built, maybe it was about 50 years ago, as a town, a hydro town. It was built just to build the canal system that creates a lot of the energy for New Zealand. And the town was meant to be pulled down, but the people who were living here just at the end said, "No, we want to stay." So it ended up staying. So it's a lovely little town full of trees, because everybody who had a house back then were all given, 20 trees or something. So we've got lots of fruit trees in the backyard. And,
is it very touristy?
It's not, no. Because it meant to be a town that was meant to be pulled down. So it's full of like a housing commission sort of houses. But in recent years, there's been a lot of building on the outside.
Yeah.
It's not touristy, but it's a place New Zealanders come to. They come here to go rowing, because Lake Ruatanifa is one of the rowing centres of New Zealand for school kids, and has a big carnivals, every year. And fishing, a lot of fishing in the canals and things like that. And obviously not far from Mount Cook, and it's a cheaper place to stay than Mount Cook. It's one of those places that hopefully will not ever get too touristy.
Do you ever find yourself in the North Island taking photos at all?
Yes. We ran workshops up there maybe about 5 or 6 years ago. In fact, we ran 3 workshops based in Rotorua, and part of that trip was taking a trip out to White Island.
Talk us through that. What was that like?
That White Island, it truly was amazing. The colours, the smell, the toxicity in the air, the drama getting off on and off the boat to get on the island and then roaming around. And the first time we were on there with just Mike and myself to do a reconnaissance, we asked the boat operator, "Is it okay if we can just go off on our own?" photographers.
No,
he says. But it wasn't a really full trip, and he had a spare guide. He said, "You can just take one of the guides on your own," and so that was great. And we actually decided to do a little funny thing while we were there. We took some of those white overalls that you get for painting, and so we dressed up as if we were scientists and took photographs of each other with all the masks on and helmets and things, photographing through white on them, and put a little book, made a little audio visual, and. had some fun there. So
what was
I've used it. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Jackie. But what was the feeling like? I mean, look, I've seen White Island in the flesh from the shore, but was there, you know, when you were on the island, was there like a, you know, did it have a certain mana to it, like a vibe?
Yeah. The vibe is like, this is volatile. Mm. This is don't go off the track. Once you start to get there, you can just see that. You could fall into a pit and disappear and be cooked. The smell, and when you get up to the edge of the crater, the sulfuric sort of acidy stuff coming at you, and you certainly wanted to wipe yourself down as soon as you got back to the boat. So there was a sense of danger, but also a sense of like, well, you know, I'm here and I'm doing it, and anything can be dangerous. Crossing a busy street in Asia is dangerous, you know, as far as you're trying to weave through traffic. You have to always make the most of life, and some things you do have to push those limits.
Did you?
Yeah. Happy.
Sorry, just bloody cut you off again. Sorry about that, Jackie. But was it one of those places where you went there and you sort of thought, this is actually just too dangerous? Because, I mean, it was well known as an active volcano. I mean, actually, was it active or dormant? But, it's a hot spot.
It's a hot spot. And people, there's relics of past volcanic activity on there, the relics of old buildings and things like that. Is it too dangerous? No. Yes. It depends what day you turn up, I took on a trip further on. I took my Janet, my daughter, on that one of the workshops. So, you know, I knew I'd been there, but I was still prepared to take my family with me. You know, you can't live your life in fear. And so everybody took a chance. You know, you take a chance getting on a plane. You take a chance getting on it. You know, doing lots of things, and you just got to. You know, follow your instincts, and if you're booked in on trip and all of a sudden you feel like, oh, maybe I shouldn't do this today, then don't go, but maybe just because maybe there will be a problem.
So follow your instincts.
Follow your instincts,
And boy, does it stink. Hey, Jackie.
Rotorua does, anyway.
Nice one.
Where's your favourite place to photograph in the world? Is it New Zealand, or have you found somewhere else in the world that's better?
It could be my woodpile, That's it. It doesn't have to be far from home.
She was going to say Dunsborough, Fletch.
Look, New Zealand is really fantastic because it changes so much. You can go over a mountain range and move into another valley and the landscape has changed. Where, I know in Australia it takes a long time to get between different looks and different places, and they're still always full of gum trees. We don't have many gum trees here. Yeah, Antarctica, that was amazing, wasn't it? Just incredible, and I could go back there again and again. But, we have a little mini Antarctica up here at Mount Cook. We have a lake full of icebergs, and it's what you make of it. They're not always as big, there's still zodiacs go out and move around them. And as that glacier keeps retreating and breaking off and carving off, it's going to be a future where perhaps that won't happen. Because planet's warming up and things are changing, and perhaps less travel in the future is part of what we'll be doing. We'll be staying at home a bit more. Planet doesn't need all those planes flying around, and it's amazing what you can do from your own base, and what makes life a little bit difficult, but that's good. Yep.
What's lockdown been like in New Zealand?
Lockdown has just changed last Thursday. It was on what they call level 3, which meant that you could. Well, level 4, let's go to level 4. That was the big one. It jumped to level 4. That's where everybody had to stay within their own area. You could go to the shopping, go shopping and do some exercise. Fortunately, Twizel's only 1,500 people. It's only got two small supermarkets and one chemist. And you can ride around town, and that was pretty easy for us. There was no waiting at the supermarket so there's less people inside because there's only ever three or four people inside. It's a good supermarket, but it's anyway. So that was for New Zealand, and New Zealanders pretty well behaved themselves. They did their separation and washed their hands and stayed away and stayed home. And it's only now that we're at level two that that things have really loosened up. We were at level three for 2 weeks to make sure that there were still no numbers, and now level two means everybody's back at school and people are back at work, but all those workplaces are still need to have separation, and you still got to wash your hands and all those things. And I think that's the new norm, you know, that more that higher level of hygiene. We can only have groups of 10, pretty much like Australia. I think one of the we've only had maybe 3 or 4 cases in the last week or 10 days, so we're really low.
Was there ever that feeling of impending doom?
Yeah, right at the start there was a lot of people really worried within the medical side of things. They just thought there's going to be a pandemic, and people on some of our clients who are coming on their workshop said, I don't know whether I'm not allowed to go on holidays because everybody's on high alert. We don't know what's going to happen. And as it turned out, there's maybe 3 people in hospital in New Zealand altogether.
Yeah,
but New Zealand is only 5 million people all up now. Just was announced this morning. Quite a few Kiwis came back.
That's right. Yeah.
Our population just went up.
A few Aussies were going, "Hey, Bru, get me on that plane, Bru. I'm from Kiwi land.
Get my chili
bun.
My
okay, but we did lose a few of the rugby league players came back over to Australia. Up in Tamworth there.
I mean we're very lucky down here in this area, that's for sure. Well, I agree with you too that your favorite location can be anything, anywhere, and you don't really need to travel too far from home to get great photographs. And some of my most successful photographs, the ones I like the most, have been close to home. So it's a good thing. Now look, you've held or been part of like 28 exhibitions or 26 exhibitions or something like that. I counted on you. I've done my research. Do you sell much at exhibitions, or how do you obviously you got your workshops, but do you sell many prints? How do you do the exhibitions work for you and all that stuff?
Exhibitions work because we make them the ones that were in Queenstown, the ones in recent years, I've printed onto A2 sheets of paper, and they've been pinned up on a backboard of card that we can recycle and reuse. So it's not so expensive because it's just on the paper and they're pinned onto the paper, clipped onto the papers, and then so there's no big mounting problem. The reason why we wanted an exhibition is to finish off work, to represent who we were. These were mostly exhibitions of Mike and mine together in recent years, where we called them symbiosis.
We're both
shooting in the same place, but you're getting a different sort of viewpoint of that idea, and that they sort of makes the images sort of talk and have a bit of a dialogue. And those images become part of books. I've never really had exhibitions to try and make money. The exhibitions were as a point of satisfaction of completing things and having something exist. That's the making of it, the printing, that part of it, the finishing off, and then they all can go down into a box and it could be filed away quite simply without taking up too much room, because framework takes up a lot of room unless you reuse those frames. The way we make a living is more from books and the workshops, and that's enough. We don't have to make a lot of money to live a good life. We don't have boats and we don't have lots of things. We have photography and we put money into our gear, but we do get sponsorship. Canon helped there and Capture One there for a while, and ASO, so we're lucky to get a bit of support that way.
Jackie, how did you meet your husband?
So Mike's my second husband, okay? So, yeah.
It's all right, we've all been.
I haven't.
Not with a husband.
Only as a husband. So I do have 2 children, and they live in Australia. I met Mike through the Photographic Awards in Australia. So he was a Kiwi, but he was a judge in New South Wales Photographic Awards. And he was there early on when I won the – I came runner-up in the New South Wales landscape category with my aerial photographs that subsequently, when they went to national, won outright. There was – so I was there with my dad in the audience, and Mike was one of the judges, and he was talking really eloquently, and he seemed like a nice kind of guy, and I didn't know anybody. And so after – there was an awards night that night, and I became runner-up, and I went up to Mike and I said, oh, look, here's my dad, and I introduced him, and we had a chat, and I said, look, if I do okay in over in Perth, can you give me a call? Because, you know, this is a time before live streaming, and it was always – I wasn't on the pulse of what was really happening. And I sort of, here's a number, here's my phone number, and maybe you just let me know, or you can text me, you know.
What a pickup line.
That old trick.
No. It's true. No. But as it, you know, it's one of those things, that, you know, I found Mike. But I didn't know that Mike had seen me many years before and thought that he liked me as well. Mm. As it turned out, so when I went, I got phoned up. Mike didn't ever call me. But I got phoned up on a Sunday night from the APA committee, and they said, Jackie, we need you in Perth tomorrow. Oh, and I'm going, all right. They go, well, actually, okay, we'll have to tell you you've won outright and we need you here. And so I said, okay, I'll see what I can do. And I rang around. I could get a trip. I could get a flight from Canberra to Perth that was going to cost over $1,000. You know, it was expensive over that, you know, quick and back. So I rang them up and they said, that's fine. I said, right. And I booked my flights and I turned up in Perth. And really the only person I knew was Mike. And I didn't. And so I phoned him up. I don't know, texted him. And he knew I was coming, as it turned out, because the way the committee got hold of me was through that phone number that I gave Mike. Because anyway.
So
long story.
He's a West Australian, is he?
No, he's a Kiwi. He's a Kiwi Christchurch. No, he was from Christchurch.
Ah.
Yeah, and he was living in Sydney. He'd been living in Sydney for 20 years.
Yeah.
So it happened to be that the judging was in Perth that year for many years, and it has never gone back.
Yeah.
It was one year that it was actually in Perth, and so I had to go all the way across there.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, and all the judges would go across to Perth, and it was, you know, a big family. The Appas were a big family, and they still are. Mm. They're really looking after people through this whole crisis, I think, you know, giving lots of education out there.
Mm. Yeah.
So I met Mike through the Appas. There you go.
So just
he's good for something.
It's like, oh, can you check? Can you have a look at my photos and tell me what you think?
Or, forget about Tinder.
Yeah. Tinder. I did that. Yeah. I had actually gone up to Mike about a year or so before at a conference somewhere. Also with my street photography, early street photography, and I said, "Oh, can you have a look at it?" You know, I was really a novice there. And Peter Eastway, he was one of my gurus. I looked up to him, and his magazine, so Better Photography, was the best thing out. Tell you,
Sir Peter.
I know, Christian. You guys, I know you have a bit of bantering going on.
Oh yeah,
Peter. He's a great guy.
He is a great guy. Yeah, he's good fun. We always have him on, and he's always a real good laugh. So look, you've got books. Are you still selling books now? Have you got books for sale? How do people get hold of those? Can they find them?
They'll find them on our website under bookstore. So our website is QCCP. Q for Quack, C for Charlie, P for Peter, something like that, .co.nz. Okay. Which was Queenstown Centre for Creative Photography, but now we're Creative Photography Workshops because we don't live in Queenstown anymore.
But we
kept the website because that's all part of it. So we run, we've made 4 how-to books because that's a lot of what we do. We teach the books on creative landscape ideas and creative travel ideas. The ideas behind it and then the technical details of doing it. Mike's just put out a couple of books in his lockdown called Views from the Lounge, which was we had this amazing view in Queenstown for 10 years. So we're still working. I've got books to put out myself on the stuff, my creative journey through life. When I work that out, Christian, I'll let you know. So thanks to you. It's really nice that you've been following some of that. But you know, I'm still trying to work that out and put it to words. It's hard when you just want to keep making, because then you, to make books, you have to really slow down. It takes a lot of time, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, but it's so rewarding.
Who is Jackie Rankin?
Jackie Rankin is a photographer. Isn't an arts based photographer. Somebody who has hopefully a bit of freedom to do what she likes. I'm a teacher, a mother, a wife, a gardener. I like to make things. You know, I get up with some tools. Yeah, a bit of a woodworker. I can put a hole through a wall and do a bit of home maintenance. Yeah, I used to be pretty fit back in those days. Used to run triathlons and fly hang gliders and had a pilot's license.
Oh, really? You know.
Wow.
You flew hang gliders?
Yeah, I did.
Fantastic. Yeah. That's sad. I mean, you got some good flying sites. Yeah, there's some great flying sites over in New Zealand. You could, have you thought about getting back into it?
I could. But any of those things, though, you need to practice quite a lot. Mm. Otherwise, it's really dangerous.
Yeah,
and if you can't get out, you die. Yep. You know.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
It's also for the young, because you can hurt yourself, and it's harder. You know, not that I'm that old. What am I? You know, 58 or something now. Yeah. And it's good to do things when you're younger, because you can bounce back quicker.
Yeah.
Your instincts are a bit quicker as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It is more of a young person's sport, I guess, those sort of things. Mm. We've got to talk a little bit about the Mono Awards, which are coming up. And I'm thinking I might enter, because it's so funny, because I was thinking, Mono Awards. Well, I never do any black and white. I hardly ever do black and white. And then so last night I was just sitting on my computer. I was getting all my images and I was converting them one by one. I was just converting into black and white, going, oh, okay. Oh, that's kind of cool. Oh, that looks nice and black and white. Oh, so these awards are presented by DigiDirect and in association with Australian Photography Magazine. So you're one of the judges. Are there other judges, or is it just you, Jackie?
There must be other judges. I don't know who they are.
Yeah, all right. We got your address, so we can send you a little envelope with some, just little thank yous in there from us.
50 thank yous.
It's all anonymous.
Unmarked bills.
Here's my advice to you, Christian. Don't just turn your colour photographs to black and white. Uh-huh. Just don't go with monochrome. If you're going to do that, then do it in a way so you can move your sliders up and down, so you can see what the red slider will do and the orange, you know, so you can enhance tones. Okay.
Yep. All right.
I'd also, you know, sometimes also a colour photograph will need to be, you need to add a bit more contrast to make it pop a little bit more. Okay.
Yep. All right.
Think about that.
Okay.
And so if you said a car keys come up and do you prefer BMW, Audi, Holden, or a Toyota?
Toyota.
Toyota, right? Okay.
Yeah. You know, I got a gig last year for an ad for Toyota RAV4.
Oh yeah.
And they sent me up to Auckland to be photographed for an ad, and I had to sit there and
saw that.
They never sent me a RAV4, but I would have.
You always wonder that sort of stuff, don't you? Because you see, you know, Murray Fredericks doing ads for Colourbond and stuff. You're sort of wondering, does he get free roofs, or you know, does Jackie get a free RAV4?
Yeah, no. I was there with the guys. I was just trying to say, look, it'd be really good. You should give me one. I can photograph it in the landscape.
I totally agree. That's a great idea.
There's still time yet. You know, I have an idea, so see what happens.
Yeah. So anyway, just harping back to the Mono Awards, because I want to talk about it's the only dedicated black and white competition in Australia. There's three categories. There's people, places, and animals. So that's good for you, Carmen. Actually, no, it's not good for you, Carmen, because there's no category for car keys, you know.
Or power tools,
yep. It's open to photographers in New Zealand and Australia, and there's $12,000 in cash and prizes that you could win, sponsored by DigiDirect and Memento.
I'm entering. I'll take a photo of something today.
$12,000 worth of stuff, but I'm sure that's And the winning images will be published by Australian Photography and Capture magazine later this year. Closes the 14th of June. And if you want to get over to the website, it's themonoawards.com.au. And it's spelt, you know, it's pretty much the way it should be spelt. Mono being M-O-N-O, not M-O-N-N-O or M-O-O-O-N-O.
Stop.
No. Thanks, Christian. Thanks, Christian. That's enough. Okay. You know, the big difference about the awards this year, of this award, last year it was called the Black and White Awards. There were some images that were put in that were monochrome, and so they got disqualified. Because a monochrome image can be a blue and black and white.
Yeah, right.
It can be you know, brown tones. CPR, it can be tones. But, so this year it's a little bit more open, which is great.
Okay. What's your favourite colour, Jackie?
the most appropriate tone or shade, I should say, for the picture, for the subject matter. There you go.
Oh,
it's
boy,
got a suit.
Makes it hard. You know, I'm trying to get some...
Get some kits. So, you know, if you did a night, maybe it's a night shot, maybe blues. Blues are cold, good shots for, you know, icy.
If you got
something a bit more nostalgic, might be sort of the sepia tones.
Yeah,
but, you know, you can't beat a good black and white. You know, I still quite like, there's some good apps out there, Nik software that has a Silver Effects Pro that can help people along the way and add that sense of, you know, grain. But really, it's finding a good subject, knowing what the subject is, and then trying to express that, make that have a narrative and be emotive and have layers and correctly capture your eye. Don't be too complicated. But,
So maybe the car keys on the kitchen bench is probably a bit too complicated, Carl.
Well, just
a good thing though.
Yeah, no, look, I got them the other day, and just the way the light hit them from the kitchen window, I just looked at it and thought that's, it's obviously representative of the duality of a man, you know, right there. Jackie, now you touched on this before. You've recently you started shooting colour again. When you're shooting for the Mono Awards, and you know, I appreciate that most people have already sort of done their shots already, but you're actually shooting from I'm actually colorblind, so I do this naturally anyway, but you're shooting from a mono point of view. Is that what you're going for in the shot?
So if I've got an idea of a photograph and I think it would be better in black and white, I'll change the camera settings to black and white.
Yeah,
you'll then be able to see and pre-visualize the outcome much better.
But when you thinking about the composition, are you thinking in black and white?
You try not think, you try and feel in black and white.
feel
because it's I'm a woman. Maybe you guys have got feelings too.
But no,
as you push your exposure up into the brighter tones with black and white, they become more ethereal. You blow areas of boring blue skies, they become white, you know. You can shoot in any time of the day in black and white, and you find shadows are not just not a shadow, they're a shape, an interesting shape. So you go looking for interesting shapes, things. Backlighting is a great thing for black and white, because the light will wrap around your subject, and they're the ways that you get feelings. But also, you know, it's all about light, you know, early morning light, low angles of light for the landscapes and the portraiture. I don't need to see somebody's whole face, you know. It's seeing part of a face. It's alluding to a personality, or it's you're seeing character.
This is great. I'm excited because Carmen's coming down. we've just opened our regions up, and Carmen's coming down from Perth tomorrow, so we're going to go out shooting together.
Yeah.
And we're going to the big Sugarloaf Rock, which is iconic. SLR, Sugarloaf Rock.
Yeah.
And I'm going to set my camera to black and white.
Black and white.
Just to have a look, because I am shooting with the Leica now. I got the SL2. And I do love that, and you know, Leica's always been sort of synonymous with black and white. And I'm gonna go out there black and white. I'm gonna ditch the tripod. I'm gonna go for some intentional camera movement. I'm gonna
okay. So you're going to have to take a filter with you. Yeah? Don't forget your filters.
Ah, filter. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Do you, right. you use filters when you shoot, Jackie? Because, or?
Well, if you're going out in the daytime mm. and you're wanting to get some intentional camera movement, you need to get a slow shutter speed. So yes. you're going to have to take a neutral density filter, okay? And the right. filter. Yeah. And so they're the kind of filters I use. I'd use neutral density filters from 9-stop to 10-stop, or they call it the big stoppers, you know,
yep.
something that
yep.
you can and a polarizer. Used to use a neutral density graduated filter, but I don't as much these days. It tends to be that you use the your raw file drop yeah. down and then drop down. Yeah, pull back those details there, but it's yeah. still a good idea.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. Oh, we're going to have a lot of fun. We got the S1Rs. We got some nice Leica lenses. We're going to go out and have a bit of fun. Just two boys. You know, we'll probably start. You know, what time are you getting down, Carmen?
Probably around lunchtime, mate. I bought a bag of goon yesterday as well, just for
Loaf rock and goon.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
What could go wrong?
All right, Slippy you need rock. To take a dress. Okay, you need to take a dress and so Carmen can be dressed up. Put him in a dress up on the rock or something like that. Bit of flowing motion, you know. Do some modelling for you. Okay, because the blaring motion you won't notice. And make sure he's in white, probably a white dress would be good.
I tell you what, we've spent that much time in lockdown, I'll pretty much do anything at the moment to get out of the house. So, yep, I'll take one for the two.
He's got some dresses at home that he likes to pull out every now and then. So.
Fletch, excellent. Jesus!
All right. Hey, Jackie, what's coming up for you? What's happening going forward? What's coming up? You got workshops, you got exhibitions, books?
Yeah. So, we've got some workshops coming up. We just put out a newsletter last night, and we've got some bookings today already for some Kiwis coming down to Twizel. So a little kind of retreat. Getting people going, but in this case, you know, people driving in their own cars, so there's a bit more separation there.
Yeah.
So that's July, so that's next month, and then we've got a New Zealand workshop up until November, happening either on the West Coast or Stewart Island. And we've got different destinations that we go to, Otago.
Yep.
And we had planned to go to Turkey in November. We'll have to see what's happening there. So the world might not have opened up by then, and that's fine. I'm quite happy to stay back in New Zealand, but wait for things to open up, because when people do travel, I guess there will be less people around, and there'll still be much more of that people being careful.
Well, there's talk about New Zealand and Australia having a reciprocal bubble arrangement.
Trans-Tasman bubble. That's good.
What are the Kiwis think about that? Because I don't really like the Aussies that much after the underarm ball.
Kiwis. I know people down in Queenstown are desperate. They really like the Aussies coming down.
Taking photos of the Wanaka tree.
The Wanaka tree. This lower branch got cut off.
Yes. That's a start.
Okay. So, that Wanaka tree is good. We want the Australians to come over, and we want New Zealanders to go over there too. I think it's good for, I don't want to say it's good for the economies as such, but I think it's good for freedom. But always be mindful of, when you need to travel, that you're traveling for a good I guess to get some good value out of it, not just because you think you should, make the most of what you can do. We all need economies to go, but we're also trying to, in New Zealand, pull back on having too many tourists, because New Zealand was getting too full. A lot of the rest of the world coming, and not always respecting our landscape, and we weren't coping with it. Too many campers and freedom campers, they call them.
Yeah.
So we're trying to encourage government to be a bit more careful about the reopening, and that there's a bit more control.
It's a strange balance, isn't it? Because firsthand, I've seen tourism in New Zealand, and it is quite out of hand. But you've got to have that. But you don't want that.
It's the big players. It's the the big boats, you know, the big companies that require, they've built themselves up a big brand that want lots of numbers. But there's lots of small players like Mike and myself, our company, and a lot of the smaller companies don't need huge numbers. So we need to just get those companies who want to have thousands of people going through there every week to say no. You know, Milford Sound should be, there should be a limit on the amount of people who are allowed and all their tracks and things like that.
More authentic experience.
More authentic experiences, yeah.
There has to be a limit on how many sand flies per person as well, because, you know, 300 sand, are they sand flies or midges? What are those things that bite you down there?
Same thing, yeah.
Yeah,
sand flies, midges, yeah.
Oh, they're horrible.
Yeah. Well, that's when you come in summer.
Okay.
You know, summer is good for parts of New Zealand, but the days are so long, it's not great for landscape photography, and that's why we don't actually run workshops in summer, because the days, it's not getting dark until 9:30, 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And then you've got to be up really early, so crazy.
I remember that at when we did phase one workshop together, Jackie, you remember? Mm-hmm. And when it came over, and we were having dinner before we went out shooting for sunset. So we'd be having dinner at 8:30, and it's like, it looks like 5 o'clock in the afternoon sort of thing. And yeah, and you're around, it's going, wow, this is so strange. And it was long days for sure.
So, like the most, the reason I say this is we had a chat last week with Gary Krantich. Is that right? It's
Krantich.
And, you know, the conversation morphed into, you know, snakes flying out of the air and biting you on the face and, you know, being mauled to death by kangaroos and that sort of stuff. And I made the comment that actually quite a large proportion of our audience is in the United States, and we probably scared them off from ever coming to Australia ever again, because, you know, everything here kills you. But New Zealand, you know...
Nothing kills
No.
There's nothing. There's no snakes. Well, no snakes. A few smart spiders, but nothing.
They're really not poisonous, though, are they?
There's a little white tail, not down south, but up in the Auckland, there's a few little white tails around, but nothing like a red-backed spider, no.
Mm. There is the drop possums, though. The drop possums are pretty
It's epic. Only when you drop off a rope on the side of a bridge.
That's true, isn't it? Drop possums.
Yeah.
Because there was this... I was going to say there was a conspiracy theory, you know, saying that they weren't true, but it is actually true, isn't it? Anyway.
Hey, we make them into garments over here. They become a wool mix, a very good garments, very warm and cozy. Actually,
Mike has got, he's got a possum hat, hasn't he? I'm sure I've seen him in a possum hat.
Seriously?
Yes. Oh, it looks like a possum hat. Red. No, it's just a cheapy little hat. No, it's not a possum. You could dream it. That's all right.
Yeah, I've got a fake one as well. It's not a real possum hat. Yeah. Okay. Hey, Jackie, it's been fantastic chatting with you. Thank you for your time. It's always great to hear from you and see you again after quite a few years. Love your work. Keep inspiring us with your creativity.
I'll try. Well, you can go and see me on Instagram. That's probably where I post. I don't post every day. I'm not a great big blogger, but I try and put some work out every couple of days when it's something worthwhile.
Yeah, well, definitely most of the stuff you put out is worthwhile. So we love to keep going. Enjoy it. Say hello to Mike for us.
Will do.
And we'll have to get you on again in the future, because it's always nice chatting.
Oh, great. Thank you. Thanks, Christian.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks, Carmen. Okay. Cheers, mate.
Talk soon.